Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
It's nearly all over. In fact, when you're listening to this podcast, it might be all over already. Yes, the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. The greatest winter sports stars on the planet all competing for gold medals. And I've got a former Winter Olympic champion on the podcast this week. It's another speed skater. Casey Fitz-Randolph is on the program. You might remember him from the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, where he won the 500 meters in speed skating, breaking the Olympic record in the process. And the American speaks to me on this week's Best in the World with Richard Parr. And we talk about what he's up to now. I won't give away what his job is. In fact, you'll already know if you've read the show notes. But if you haven't read the show notes, I'm not going to tell you now anyway. But Casey makes the comparison to his job that he does now to what his life was like as a sports star and what he's learned from speed skating that he can use in his current career. One of the particular things that we discuss is risk and reward. That's a topic we've covered a few times with various sports stars, but Casey gives a really unique perspective on that in this podcast. He talks about what he did differently between the 1998 games in Nagano to what he did to become the champion in 2002. He talks about his time working with the Canadian speed skaters. He, of course, is from Wisconsin. He is an American, but after those 1998 games, he decided to go and train with Canada. He explains why and also the benefits he got from it on this podcast, talking to me on The Best in the World with Richard Parr. Before we do that, I want to say about Audible. Audible is one of the leading suppliers of audiobooks in the world. They've got over 180,000 titles for you to choose from. I've recently been listening to a book called 80-20 in Sales and Marketing by Perry Marshall. It's a really interesting book. It's not very long. It's about 5-6 hours. I listen on 1.5 times speed, and it gives you lots to think about of using the 80-20 percentage, the Pareto law, I believe it's called, where 20% of everything you do ends up accounting to 80% of the results. And it's really made me think about a few different things. So it is a book I would recommend you to have a listen to, as it doesn't take too long, 5 hours, and then at 1.5 times speed, that's about 3 hours. And I think it's really worth it. And you can listen to it for free. All you've got to do is go to audibletrial.com/best. That will give you a free 30-day trial of Audible service. And that includes one free audiobook download. And it could be 80-20 in Sales and Marketing by Perry Marshall. Go and check it out. Let me know what you think of it as well. Send me a tweet at Richard_Parr. Or we can talk a little bit more about it at the Best in the World Facebook group. I'll put a link to that on the show notes page as well. But yes, if you want to learn from the very best, if you want to get increased knowledge using audiobooks, go check out Audible. Go get a 30-day free trial. audibletrial.com/best. All right, let's learn on this podcast from the Olympic speed skating gold medalist, Casey Fitz-Randolph.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
Casey Fitz-Randolph, welcome to the Best in the World with Richard Parr. Of course, one of the most impressive accolades of your career was becoming Olympic champion back in 2002. Obviously, that's a while ago now. So let's begin, Casey, with what are you up to at the moment?
Well, I now have, let me say thank you, Richard, for having me on. I appreciate it. I've enjoyed looking up some of your past interviews, and quite frankly, getting inside the head of people that have become the best in the world at what they do is something of real interest to me. You know, people all function a little bit differently, and yet there are some similarities there as well. And so I'm always curious about the mental side of sport and people that have had success in sport. So happy and honored to be a part of it. In terms of my life after skating, it's, well, in one word, normal. I have a blessed life, and that means I have a wife with two children. Our kids are have just turned 11 and 9. We've got a son, Sawyer, and a daughter, Cassidy, and we live in a small town outside a mid-sized city here in the state of Wisconsin. And I have a job in business insurance. So stay seated. I know that's exciting. but that's a little bit about what we're up to. We have a couple of farms that we get away to, and right now I'm spending a lot of time chasing our kids around and carting them around to their sporting activities when I'm not at the office.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for your nice words about the podcast. It is interesting what you say about how there's some similarities and differences, because when I speak to different guests, part of me is expecting an answer sometimes that I've heard before, and then they give me something completely different. a few things to pick up there, Casey, and I want to talk about your job at the moment, working in insurance. And when I did my research, I heard you talk about it before, and you said one of your roles was helping small to mid-sized companies manage their risk. And that really intrigued me, because one of those common themes that I've found with different sports stars is a few of the really highly talented innovators of the sport almost try a high risk, high reward. Firstly, is that something that you tried as an athlete? And if so, how does that work with you trying to sell insurance?
I'm utterly confused. No. Well, you know, it's interesting. I consider the sport of speed skating to be a lesson in managing risk, quite frankly. We're going 40 miles an hour, whatever that is in kilometers, and we're doing that on a blade that's, you know, 2 millimeters in width. And so while you're trying your hardest, you also need to be cognizant or aware of how much you're leaning, how sharp your blades are, when you can apply pressure into the ice to generate speed versus not. Because ultimately, if we don't stay on our feet or on our skates, then we surely don't win. So, you know, another thing that I do since retiring from skating is a fair amount of public and motivational speaking. And one of the ties that I make between speed skating and risk management for businesses is just that, risk management and managing risk and how you do it. So yes, you have to take a lot of risks to become a sporting champion. Quite frankly, you have to take risk to be successful at any endeavor in life. But I think there's something to be said for smart and educated risks. And that was the case in training as well. You know, it was not always about more hours and more hours and more hours of training. It was a combination of a high volume, but also knowing when to back off and knowing when you needed rest and sleep and the right food. So everything in life is calculated if we're vested in trying to be the best that we can be.
Talking about working smarter, more necessarily than harder. What else do you think that you've been able to take from your career as a speed skater, as an elite athlete, that you have been able to use in your day-to-day life, in your office life, so to speak?
Yeah, well, there's a lot to be said for hard work. And if I'm being honest, I thought when I got done skating that given the platform it provided for me and the name recognition, that I would not have to work as hard to make a good living moving forward. And it took me a few years to come to grips with the fact that I was wrong. When we start over in life with a new career, we have to work really hard to be successful, just like we did the first time. So in many ways, it's different, of course, from being a professional athlete. But you need to work hard, regardless of whether people like your name or want to be with you socially. If somebody's going to trust you in a professional career long term, then you need to do things that allow them to trust you. And typically that means working harder than most other people and being persistent. I will say, that having been said, if I may, I got into sales because I thought, well, this will be like sports. I can control my own destiny. I have flexible hours, flexible income. I can, work when I want to work and take off when I want to take off. It was not nearly as parallel as I expected. In the real world, as I'll call it, the world of sales and business, there are a lot of things outside your control, right? As a speed skater, the clock doesn't lie. The fastest man wins, and you have a very high level of control over your results. In the working world, we're dealing with people. And all of us people can be irrational at times. And so it's not nearly as black and white as skating in circles.
Was the plan always to work in insurance or in some kind of sales, or did you have a plan for when you would retire from sport?
No, I thought about a lot of things. And when I retired, I came back home here to the Madison, Wisconsin area. And I probably looked into a dozen different career choices. And I narrowed it down to two. One was insurance and risk management, sales. And the other was what we call community affairs or a public relations position for the large hospital and healthcare system associated with our university here in town. And so the community affairs position would have been a fun job. I would have been finding ways to spend their money and where do we do promotional advertising, and it would have been involved TV and things. But an insurance, maybe not so sexy, but I wanted the flexibility that came with, the sales role. So I wanted to be able to control my time and how it was spent and also my income.
Obviously, as a sports star, a lot of athletes are reliant on sponsorship and gaining their own sponsors. Is that something you had to do as a speed skater? And was there anything, if that was true, was there anything that you learned doing that you were able to bring into this job that you're doing now? And vice versa, is there anything in that you wish you'd know to help you get sponsorship as an athlete?
Well, speed skating in America is not the equivalent of football or baseball or basketball or car racing, right? So we had to be a little bit creative. At first, I thought we could approach it like the Dutch do, maybe, in offering, a company logo on my uniform in exchange for money. But companies in America, if we're being honest, they really don't care about that. We don't get enough TV time. So we needed to find other ways to create value. And typically that meant we were offering a certain number of speaking engagements either to their general workforce or their sales staff or to their, important clients or to their executive team or to their charity of choice. And so, you know, we needed to find a way, again, to create value and offer these companies, you know, a motivation or a motivating reason to give Casey Fitzrandolph, Olympic speed skater, money to help me, you know, train and live. And so that's how we did it. We did it outside of just, you know, their logo on the uniform. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, you know, learning from that, you know, it stuck with me certainly because we need to create value for those around us. If we're just thinking primarily about, you know, what is best for us and how can I get more, that's not a good long-term solution, right? Mm-hmm. We need to figure out what other people want from us and how we can give them that. And then from there, we need to back into, you know, a fair and reasonable price or deal.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
More from Casey in just a moment. This is obviously episode 105 of The Best in the World with Richard Parr. So that means I've spoken to over 100 world and Olympic champions on this podcast. And I've picked up a few tricks and tools along the way on getting these high-profile interview guests. And I've put 7 of the best tips and tools for getting high-profile interview guests into an article. And you can get that article. I've put a link to it on the show notes page. You can get it there and you can read those 7 tips and tools to get high profile interview guests so you can improve your podcast, your YouTube channel, your blog. It can help you connect with the people that you are interested in speaking to, not just sports stars. If you're into pop culture, if you're into psychology, if you're into other types of science, this will give you tools that you can use to speak to the real leaders in your field. So go and check it out. 7 tips and tools to get high profile interview guests. I'll put a link to it on this show notes page. All right, let's return to the conversation with Casey Fitzrandolph.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
You mentioned your children. Do you have 2 budding young speed skaters on your hands?
No, I'd like to tell you yes, but our kids, our son is into soccer and our daughter is into a number of sports, still pretty young, but primarily cheer. So I don't know if cheer is a big sport overseas in England or across Europe. Do you guys have a lot of...
Not really in the UK. Yeah. A few of the football clubs here do, but they're nowhere near as athletic.
Got it. Okay. Well, it's become a really big deal here in America, and a lot of young ladies do it. And so, you know, they're doing gymnastics and, you know, on the stage, and then they're doing these pyramids and, you know, getting people up high and throwing them around. And so she's into that. And our son... And his, you know, well, we would say soccer, you would say football. Mm. He is a lot of fun. He's a, you know, we all love our children, and but he's wired in a way that he wants to be. He wants more. He wants to be the best. He wants, you know, a bigger challenge every night. He wants to play with the older kids and practice with the older kids. And so we just went to a regional tournament this past weekend, 7 hours away, and, you know, he comes back even more fired up. So right now, quite frankly, my favorite thing in life is driving him around to his football practices and games.
Superb. It's just a shame for him that he won't be able to see the United States at the World Cup later this year. that wasn't meant as a dig, but...
it could be meant as a dig. But disappointed.
I hear you were a pretty decent soccer player, Casey.
Well, I did some, yes. But, you know, it's amazing how much the sport has evolved and developed here in America. You know, they're learning concepts and footwork and ball skills at age, 10 that we were learning at age 16. And so it's really cool to see. And it's also baffling that we're not any better on an international level, because we do have a lot of kids playing soccer here in America. So I played it for 4 years in high school and played some club. And then had to focus on, and I kicked for American football team as well in high school and college a little bit. And then I had to choose one sport, and that became speed skating.
Mm. And one of the reasons I asked whether your children were speed skaters is because I wanted to know if they were, whether you would motivate them with money like your father did to you and your brother. I hear that you were motivated with, I believe, a dollar bill onto who would ever win. Is this true?
Well, so it was me and my sister, and she was a couple of years younger. But you're right, I did have a sibling that skated, and she was very good. My folks, tried to motivate us any way they could, and sometimes that meant a dollar bill. Sometimes that meant chips to go along with our sandwich. There were a lot of different motivators that they used. You know how it is with a family that has kids who are very involved in sports. It becomes a lifestyle, and it becomes important, not just to the kids, but to mom and dad as well. So I would use the word precarious line to draw in the sand, from mom and dad's perspective. On one hand, you want to provide every opportunity you can, and as a result, you spend a lot of time and money on your children. And on the other hand, it needs to ultimately come from them, not from, not from mom and dad, if they're going to be their best.
Mm. And when did that happen for you? When did that kind of momentum shift from, the motivation from your parents to your sole motivation and almost your sole goal?
Yeah, well, that was a very interesting part of my skating career. I got into speed skating when I was 4, just about to turn 5, so very young. And I'd already been playing hockey and ice skating for a couple of 2-3 years before that. But I got into it at an early age, and I always had success here in America. But it became stressful. It became more about trying to make mom and dad, or in particular dad, happy and live up to his expectations than about doing it because I really enjoyed doing it and wanted to be the best. And I remember, Richard, a conversation that I had with my dad at their house out in the yard. I was 24 years old. I had already skated in the 1998 Olympics in Nagano, Japan, and I was home for a break from training, and I said, "Dad, I know how badly you want me to win at the world level, but you can't make it happen. It needs to come from within me, so I need you to back off. I know that you're vested in this. I know how much you care. But you've got to internalize that or talk to mom about it or somebody other than me, because it's not helping." And it was a hard conversation to have, but to his credit, he did back off. And it was at that same time that I moved up to Calgary, Alberta, and probably attained some more independence because of being 25 hours away. And my skating improved as a result.
Mm, yeah, you stopped training with the American team and started training with the Canadians. Beyond what you just mentioned there with your father, what were the other motivations and what were the improvements that you had there?
Yeah, well, so in 98, we were dealing with the introduction of the clap skate, right, which was revolutionary in the sport of speed skating. They were difficult. They were difficult to acquire, even if you were willing to pay for them. The Viking factory in Japan and in the Netherlands, long known as kind of the place to get speed skates, had made the best.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Lapskate design, and they wouldn't sell them to me.
Why?
I tried to get them, well, because I was one of their toughest competitors. And we tried. They would sell them to other Americans, but they knew the size of my foot and they knew the length of blade that I wanted. And so they would always tell us we're out of that size, we're on summer vacation. There was always an excuse. And so it was I eventually had a pair of clap skates made by an American company and you know, skated in the Olympics in 98. But in my opinion, it was not a very fair Olympics, and it was very frustrating for me and for a few of the other top skaters from the year before who were not able to get the same technology in time in far enough in advance of that Olympics. So that was an interesting games for us. But the other thing, you know, in addition to admittedly feeling sorry for myself for a little while, the other thing that I had to do was figure out what I was going to do to never allow that to happen again. And when I looked at the 500-meter results from Nagano, I was sixth. There was a Japanese guy, Hiryasu Shimizu, that won in his home country. And numbers 2, 3, 4, and 5 were all out of Canada, which meant every one of the four guys that they entered beat me. And when I saw that, I said, well, obviously they know something about how to skate on this new clap skate. So that's when I reached out to them and asked if I could come up and join them. So they taught me some things about the clap skate, but, and I didn't know this going up there when I started. More importantly, they taught me a lot about the importance of great teammates who were both very good skaters, but also very good people, very unselfish, and guys that were willing to share their mentality and their thought surrounding every component of the race from a mental perspective. So that's why I went on to have the success that I did while training with Jeremy Witherspoon and Mike Ireland up in Canada.
Up to that point, had you only ever seen this as a individual sport? Had you only ever seen it as just you?
Yeah, I had. And, you know, that's not to say that I didn't have close friends or good teammates here in America. But from a results perspective, I came onto the scene right after Dan Jansen retired, and so I did not have the luxury of training with him. And, you know, the Americans were not as strong at that point. So to be able to move up there and train with the best, some of the best in the world, and then have them share, like I said, the secrets, you know, their mental outlook towards everything, the way they did, is what propelled me. So it was a special moment, in speed skating, even in Canada, in Calgary. I don't think they operate the same way anymore, but they did let me in and let me train in their system with, you know, their coaches, with their massage therapists and physical therapists, and do all the testing that they were doing. So I was a lucky man.
And you then go to the 2002 Olympics, obviously on home soil, well, American soil, as you were living in Canada. But what did you learn, other than what you've learned, say, with the Canadian team and the skates and teamwork and everything like that? What was there which helped you prepare perhaps better for these games? What did you learn from Nagano that was able to help you in 2002?
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything else?
Well, yeah, in addition to, you know, the Canadians and the clapskate, another major takeaway from Japan was, you know, I had watched one of my idols, Dan Jansen, go to the Olympics as the best in the world and fall and, you know, and fail, right? Fail until he ultimately won the 1000 in Lillehammer, Norway. And I saw him struggle at the Olympics time after time. And I told myself, Casey, when you get there to your first Olympics, you need to make it a positive experience in your own head so that the next one will be positive as well. And so I went to Nagano. I got sixth in the 500, seventh in the 1000, which were results that were not good compared to the year before, prior to clap skates, when I had been on the podium many times. And yet I had to tell myself, Casey, considering how late you got on these new skates, you did very well in Japan and should consider that a positive experience. It was true, but it was also a sell job on myself. I needed to convince myself that that was the case so that when I got there 4 years later in Salt Lake City, I could look back at my only other Olympic experience and consider it a very positive one and use all of the energy surrounding the Olympic Games to my advantage versus my disadvantage.
Mm. Was that easy to do? Because, you know, I've spoken to a lot of Winter Olympians and Olympians who they've got over their failure and had success, but a lot of them have that first month, 2 months, sometimes 3 months of, well, in some cases depression, but of feeling really low, really disappointed, really difficult their outlook on life. Were you able to almost instantly do that, going, I'm going to learn from this experience? Did you have any low moments at all?
Yes, it's a very good question. So, you know, I started telling myself that it was a positive experience as it was happening, but I struggled. I would tell you, Richard, I struggled for a year after. And it wasn't that I didn't believe I could come back or be among the best again, but I struggled with not having accomplished my dream, right? Mm. At that point, I'd been skating for 18, 19 years, and I had always been focused on, you know, a gold medal, or going to the Olympics and winning gold medals. And given how I'd skated in 97, that remained my dream, and I felt a realistic one. So when it did not happen, it was difficult for a year. Like I said, I had a pity party. I felt sorry for myself. But then, you know, sometimes we learn more from our failures or setbacks than we do from our successes. And I had to make a decision at that point as to whether I was going to, as we say, sail off into the sunset and be done and say, coulda, shoulda, woulda, or I needed to rally myself mentally and figure out how I could put every variable that I could in my favor.
Mm. Were you a man who had any superstitions or any rituals throughout your career? Is there anything you did in particular in your pre-race routine, and did it change at all?
Well, I liked to have my cornflakes for breakfast. And I had a very specific routine leading into, you know, the day of my races, leading into the races. If we had, this did not happen at the Olympics, but at a World Cup or a World Championships, we would race the 500 meter and the 1,000 meter on the same day. And so you'd get a little bit of rest in between the two, maybe 2 hours. I would have half of a Snickers bar 43 minutes prior to racing my 1,000 meters after having raced the 500.
What would happen if it would be 42 or 41?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I'm sure it was often, and I don't know. But that was my, I tried to figure out what worked, right? And and so I got pretty specific with it. That having been said, I had actually my locker number was 13, the year of 2002. And I remember telling myself, you know, it's lucky 13, Casey, not unlucky 13. Is there superstition surrounding the number 13 over there, Richard?
Yeah, it's the same as you guys, I think.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, I had to convince myself that it was lucky. But the other thing I remember spending a lot of time on going into 2002 and a huge contributor to my success was the mental side. And part of that was surrounded coping with the stress at the that was to come at the Olympic Games, and you know, my entire at that time 23-year career had been about going to the Olympics and winning a gold medal, right? It's all about a gold medal, one object, and that's how I'm going to define myself and my career. And then as I got close, meaning the year of, I realized you can't look at it that way, Casey. If you judge your career and yourself and your character on an object, on one gold medal, you are setting yourself up to fail. And so, ironically, for 23 years, I prepared for a gold medal, and then for about 12 months prior, I had to make it not about the gold medal. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about what if I succeed at the Olympics, and also what if I fail. And the only way that I could get comfortable with those scenarios was first to face the what if I fail question. And when I looked hard and long at that scenario, I came to the conclusion that it would indeed be a major bummer, a major disappointment. And yet the sun would come up the next morning, my mom would still love me and dad, my fiance, you know, my health would still be there. And it helped me put things in perspective. And once I determined that failing would be okay in the big picture, only then could I turn my attention to the what if I succeed and prepare to succeed. Because I'm a huge believer that when we go into the most important moments of our life, we all have those butterflies in the stomach, right? We all have those feelings, but we go one of two directions with them. We either go towards a fear of failure. Oh no, what if this goes wrong? I'm nervous. What if I forget this? What if I don't perform? Or we go to an excitement to succeed. Hey, this could go really well. And if this goes really well, it's going to be awesome. And here are all the reasons why. We've got to deal with the former so that we can then prepare for the latter, that success. And so that's what I focused on going into Salt Lake City.
And I think that what if I fail is something really useful that we all can do whenever we think of something difficult or something hard or something we kind of get nervous about. We have to kind of think, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? So I think that's something really, really good that we all can use from you there, Casey. When you were thinking about that, when you had in your mind that, okay, I can't be defined by the gold medal, and you mentioned being away from your father, was that time spent away from him one of the things which helped you not have that in your mind? With him, was it always that you have to get the gold medal?
I think with him it was as parents, we believe in our children, right? And we believe they can do anything they set their minds to. And so he believed that. And he saw me as his son who could do anything he set his mind to, and that included becoming the best in the world. And, he saw me succeed many times as a youngster. And so as I grew up, and as the level of competition became more and more difficult, I think in his mind it was frustrating, to see me do anything less than win. I remember telling him, Dad, it's not that easy anymore. I'm not skating against, the other kids in the state of Wisconsin. I'm not skating even against the other Americans. Now I'm competing against the best in the world. And that includes some skaters that are bigger and stronger and, more explosive than I am. So, we would go back and forth on that. And ultimately he was correct, right? His son could be the best in the world. But it was not an everyday thing. And I think, that's hard to marry a parent's perspective, especially, one that he had never competed, at a highly competitive level in sports. And so I think that maybe things were a little more black and white in his mind, than they were at least in mine.
Someone who did go through an elite level of sport was Eric Heiden, and he was your orthopedist on the team when you won gold, and obviously he's won five golds at the 1980 games. What role did he have in your career?
Well, it's funny you asked that question now, Richard, because speaking of black and white, the thing that always struck me about Eric when he would spend time around our team was how black and white his world was. He's a guy that, when you win every event and you just don't lose, then, things tend to be black and white. And so I always got the impression and the kind of aura from Eric that his thought process was one of, well, what's the problem? Just go do it, Like, why you don't, don't overanalyze this. Just get out there and do it and beat everybody. I don't want to say winning came easy to him, because we all know how hard he trained. But winning came easy to him compared to how it comes for most of us. And so he was pretty black and white. I think it was nice to have, I know it was nice to have Eric around. But again, in terms of what we learned from them, well, he was the reason I started skating, not just another American, but to see a guy from Madison, Wisconsin go out and win five gold medals at the Lake Placid Olympics in 1980, when I had just laced up speed skates for the first time on a frozen lagoon or frozen pond in Madison 3 weeks prior, was at the only thing and everything that it took to get me to believe that I could be an Olympic gold medalist in the sport of speed skating. So he was the catalyst for me to get into the sport. and the catalyst for me to believe that I could accomplish my dream for many, many years. And yet, ultimately, as I became, a man and one of the better skaters on the circuit, at that point, I think there was only so much I could learn from him because everybody handles that level differently.
Mm. Who were some of the people who you did really learn from and were mentors to you?
Well, I picked up tidbits. So my first year on the U.S. national team was Bonnie Blair's last year. Bonnie prepared differently than I did and trained differently than I did as well. But one thing I learned from Bonnie was the importance of lifestyle. And, it's about training hard, but it's also about what you do when you're not training, right? For those of us that are of modest talent, we can't afford to, go out, drinking on our rest day or eating garbage. We need to eat well. We need to get the rest that we need to get, and we really need to be all in. And I learned that from Bonnie. Jeremy Witherspoon, a teammate of mine up in Canada, who is one of the most successful sprinters of all time, maybe the most. He helped teach me how to put things in perspective, and that sport should not be about material things and awards, but rather about the journey toward becoming the best that you can be. And how close can we get to our ultimate potential and skating the perfect race for ourselves? Because ultimately, if we skate and perform at anything in life the best that we possibly can, how can we be disappointed regardless of outcome? We can't. It's just not fair or realistic. And so, put the place aside, put the time on the clock aside even. How did we perform? And if we performed well or we performed to the best of our potential, then it was a success. And ultimately, on the other hand, if we win and we didn't skate that good of a race, we should not be satisfied.
With that in mind, was the 2002 final where you won gold your best ever race?
Well, we had to skate it twice in that Olympics. And so once in each lane. And the first day was a good race. It was enough for Olympic record that actually still holds to this day, partially thanks to the venue in Salt Lake and the high altitude. The second race was it didn't go well. I was paired with Kip Carpenter, a fellow American who won the bronze, and Kip actually kicked his lane cone into my lane. My skate hit that, and I lost a lot of momentum and speed. So it could have gone better, Richard, if I'm being honest with you. And I never did skate the perfect race. They say perfection is elusive, and I would certainly agree with that.
Well, I think a gold medal is still a just reward for all of the hard work and everything that you've done. Casey, it's been a real pleasure speaking to you and learning from you on this podcast today. Before you go, Casey, can you let us know where we can continue to find you on social media and or online, and also if there's anything else you want to add on this program?
Yeah, well, I appreciate that, Richard. It's been a pleasure on my end as well. I'm a hermit when it comes to social media. So LinkedIn is one option. And then I do have a website, which is caseyfitz.com. Those are the two options. I live vicariously through my wife when it comes to all of the rest.
Fantastic. It's probably a good thing. Casey, thank you for being on the program, and thank you for being the best in the world.
Thanks, Richard.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
Brilliant stuff there with Casey, and we've spoken to quite a few speed skaters on this podcast before. Maybe we go back and listen to my conversation with Chad Hedrick. I've also spoken to Jorrit Bergsma, Jan Blokhuizen, and of course, only a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to Stefan Grootheus. They're all available at sportacino.com, at Apple Podcasts, at Stitcher, at Podbean, pretty much every single place that you can get podcasts. You'll be able to find The Best in the World with Richard Parr. And what would be really good is if you click the subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Plus, what would also really help me is if you could give us a rating and review. That would really help boost the knowledge of our show around the world. All right, that's it for this week. We're going to leave the Winter Olympics behind next week. We're going to another sport which doesn't need snow. I won't tell you exactly who it is. You'll just have to wait. Or you might get a little hint in the Best in the World Facebook group. Or you might get a little hint at our Patreon page, patreon.com/bestintheworld. But if you don't check them out, I guess you'll just have to listen to it next week. Until then, I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.
The Best in the World podcast with Richard Parr.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.